Eva was in his heart and his mind and his memory still. He'd taken a wife and bought a house, and for a good many years had kept fairly steady at the same two jobs he'd had then, one of them the very job he'd first taken simply to bring her back over. "No children," he'd say when they asked him. He'd say, "A bit of a problem with the drink." Clonmel was bigger than he'd imagined it, and as with so many of these Irish cities, not nearly as quaint. He might have been thrilled or comforted by the thought that this had been a place well familiar to her, that she'd once strolled these streets as a child, as a young woman, on the day before she left for her first appointment in Chicago, the beginning of her journey toward him, and the day she returned from New York, his diamond on her finger. But he had sense enough to know that the place was not the same city it would have seemed to her then, just before the war and just after it. He passed what looked like a Kentucky Fried Chicken shop, for instance. There was a shabby sense of change, of the modern, all about the place, that had little to do with the backward, quiet little city she had once described for him. He sensed that her ghost would have been as much a stranger here as he was. And yet it was surely some sense of her ghost that made his heart beat heavily in his chest when, according to his map, not far from where he should be, he pulled into a gas station just outside town, off to the side so he would not block the pumps, and climbed awkwardly out of the tiny Fiesta to ask for directions. The attendant was a man about his own age, in the ubiquitous Irish cap and a filthy pair of mechanic's overalls. Billy and Father Jim had already shared a joke about how every set of directions given in Ireland begins, "Go down to the church," and no doubt that was the line he was fully expecting, delivered in its usual thick, nearly incomprehensible mumbling brogue, when he asked the man how he could find the Cavanaugh place on Boylston Road. But instead, the man squinted one eye and said, "An American cousin?" It seemed to Billy to be the beginning of a declarative sentence somehow cut short by a question mark. "I beg your pardon?" he said politely. The man pushed back his cap. A deeply lined face, the lines drawn deeper with grime. Bad teeth. A once good-looking face, perhaps.
"Are you an American cousin?"
he said. Billy said no, he was only an old friend. The man looked him up and down a bit, not unpleasantly, and then looked beyond him to a car that was just pulling in. The car beeped and the driver called, "Tommy!" And the man asked Billy if he'd mind stepping into the tea shop here. His wife would be inside at the counter, and she'd be happy to draw a little map for him. It wasn't far. But there was no one at the counter, and only a single woman at a table in the corner, a blue and white cup before her, the newspaper in front of her face, a white plastic shopping bag at her feet. The place was small. It seemed to have been meant for another purpose, maybe as a place to sell windshield wipers and spare cans of oil, or as a waiting room for the garage next door. The windows were high and narrow, and each covered with handmade curtains, blue and white cotton gingham. The walls were false stucco, perhaps aiming for a cottage effect, but the floor was pale linoleum, the tables and countertop a beige formica. There were a plastic rose and a plastic fern and a white milk glass vase on each table, and a Waterford vase filled with real flowers, tall and weedy things that nevertheless gave a nice effect, beside the register. Altogether, there was something hasty and false about the place, and this was not hindsight, he felt it immediately, as if it had been quickly rearranged to hide its true purpose, as if the woman, casually lifting her cup, intent on the Irish Times, had only seconds before been at the window, looking out for him. He said,
"I beg your pardon."
And the woman quickly lowered her newspaper, as if she feared she'd been rude. "Irish face number 4, sharp chin, ruddy cheeks, good long nose, and too many teeth. Not unlike Helen O'Mara at home." He recalled one of Uncle Daniel's little ditties that ended, "So I said, Mrs. Clemen, you'd make a better lemon than you would a big red rose."
"The gentleman outside said I should ask in here for directions to Boylston Road," he told her. "The Cavanaugh place. He said I should ask his wife." Let me get her for you, the woman said, standing, smiling enough to show an impressive overbite. Are you an American cousin? She asked him over her shoulder as she headed behind the counter.
No, he said, although I'm beginning to think I should be.
She laughed as if she got his meaning.
Well, the Kavanaughs have three of them. Three of the girls who've just gone over to the States. That's why I asked. Let me just get Eva for you.
She passed through the door behind the counter. He could see a small white enamel stove, a big stainless steel kettle on top of it, a dish rag tied to its door handle, a shelf with some boxes of wholemeal biscuits, some tins of Earl Grey, a white enamel sink. He heard her say Eva again, and then a door opening, perhaps the back door to the place, and louder now she cried, Eva! Out the door, into the wind. For a moment, before the woman returned, he thought it mere coincidence. He thought it was, by some strange convergence of fact and fate, a sign of sorts from her. No, nothing so elaborate as her face in a glass, her actual voice in his ear as he slept, the kinds of signs he had imagined and hoped for so desperately in those first few months and years after her death. But a sign, nonetheless, a mild comfort. To have pulled in here, to have been directed inside, to have asked the one woman who went off to fetch the wife, whose name, it so happened, was also Eva. To hear on this day of all days, in this place, her name called out. It was a sign that said, You were right to come here. I am with you still. And then the woman returned with Eva herself coming in behind her, the bouquet of ragged wildflowers only briefly blocking her face. You could have counted on one hand the seconds it took for the two of them to know each other. Later, sitting with a cup of tea, Eva said for her it was the stoop of his shoulders, and of course those blue eyes. For him, and he, let's face it, had further to come, 30 years of distorted memory to cross, there was no single thing, certainly nothing physical, not at first, since she was so much heavier now and the pale shade of her dyed hair no longer matched her mahogany eyes. He simply knew, after that initial tumble into disbelief, he simply knew this was Eva standing before him. Well, what a lot of knots there were to untangle. He held out his hand at first, the homely lady still standing there, grinning between them. Held out his hand and said, Billy Lynch. And Eva, drying her hands on her apron like some Brigadoon Colleen, said, Billy Lynch, I know it's you. Although the blush on her cheeks when she came in from the wind didn't fade inside the shop. She introduced her friend, Bessie Gordon, and called Billy the boy from New York, like a character listed in a playbill.
Oh, sure, Bessie
said, as if she was quite familiar with the entire cast.
The shoes,
she said, nodding. The plot as well.
And all those little notes. I've always said I admired you for keeping up.
She elbowed her friend.
And her scared to death to ever send a reply. I'm the one that was always telling her she was terrible not to reply.
Eva's blush grew darker and deeper. She was blushing to her roots.
Oh, Bessie's full of advice for everyone, she said in her old laughing way. I'm thinking of setting her up in a booth.
She offered him a cup of tea and scooted back around the counter to get it. She said she had some nice scones to go with it, or a ham roll or some crackers and cheese, and when Billy refused all, she took a small chocolate bar from a pile by the register and slipped it onto his saucer. Bessie carried the cup for him to her own table, while Eva poured tea for a group of workmen who had just pushed through the door, bringing the smell of dirt and tar and the damp outdoors in with them. Eva knew every one of them by name, and on their heels two mothers, one with a toddler on her hip. She knew them both as well. And then three elderly women, one with a canvas bag decorated with a cactus and the words Flagstaff, Arizona.
The tea time rush, Bessie said. She made it sound like a ruse. No doubt it'll give Eva a chance to collect her thoughts before she has to speak to you. She's got a guilty conscience, you know. She's carried it for years.
She looked at Billy, making sure he understood. Her eyes were a dishwater grey, the skin around her nose full of scars from old blemishes and open pores.
About the money. We all know the story, the money you sent her to come back to the States. She swore any number of times she was sending it all back to you, but then there'd be another fuel crisis, or Tom would get laid up, or one of the children, and then she made up her mind to have this shop.
She paused, studying him. It was apparent that her day had taken a delicious turn.
She's been guilty about it, though, she went on, leaning toward him. Every one of us knew it. And your writing to her folks like that only made it worse. Her dad used to say you were calling in her loan.
She drilled her bony fingers along the top of her cold cup.
Honestly, you'd only have to say a single word to her and she'd pay you right back today, straight out of the till.
I've never even thought about the money, Billy said. He was watching Eva, nearing 60, matronly waist and breast, lean across the counter to chuck the chubby toddler under his chin. She's welcome to the money. Bessie Gordon drew her head back, eyeing him. He noticed that there was a wedding ring on her finger. Who'd ever believe it, a woman so ugly? A lid for every pot, as his mother used to say. She closed her lips over her mess of teeth and then pulled them into a kind of smile, sympathetic, even pleasant. This was the face, chosen above a lifetime of other faces, some husband sought his solace in.
That's what I always thought somehow, she told him. That's just how I imagined you to be.
There was a small bell ringing somewhere, a far-off fairy wing chinging sound that he gradually saw was the plastic rose knocking against the milk glass vase, both of them set moving by the way his hand was trembling on the table. Bessie saw it too, and bit her lip, all sympathy. No doubt she knew the true cause, and would add that, a drinking problem, to the tale of Eva Kavanaugh's boy from New York. He flexed the hand on the table. It was pale, bloated enough to strain against Maeve's ring.
A touch of Parkinson's, he told her, since he could not stop the tremor.
She nodded.
What a shame!
And then added,
My mother had it too.
So that Billy had to wonder who was kidding whom. When Eva finally came to the table, a cup for herself, a teapot to warm his, Bessie volunteered to take the counter for a while so they could chat undisturbed. She held out an icy hand.
It was a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Lynch, she said,
and gave Eva a look that told her, at least to Billy's eyes, that here was a man better than she knew.
Is this a holiday for you?
Eva asked brightly. It seemed to be the question she had decided on when she poured her customers their tea. He said it was.
With your family?
He said he was with some priests. It was a kind of retreat.
Lovely, she said. Her hair had been lightened to a honey blonde and no longer matched her dark eyes,
although the eyes themselves had stayed true. Her skin was rough and lined, a new downward turn to her lips, a second chin. She was back from the dead for him, there was that. But there was also half a lifetime of mistaken belief. He told her he was married, with a house, still with Con Ed, and he'd stayed at the shoe store until Mr. Holtzman sold it just before he died in 64. She had four children, all of them grown now, two with babies of their own. One of them moved to the States, to Boston, with an American husband, one in London with the BBC, two helping out here. It wasn't only her being alive that took some getting used to. It was that she had lived. It was how she had lived. She suddenly sat forward. It was a terrible thing she'd done, she said, leaving it to her sister to tell him she was marrying Tom, never sending him back his money. She couldn't imagine what he must think of her.
She couldn't imagine what had possessed her back then. "What must you think of me?" she said again, lowering her eyes and catching him trying to steady the cup, spilling tea onto the saucer, darkening the red wrapper of the candy bar. He put it down, put his hands on his lap. He knew he'd stop at the first place he came to once he left here, get himself something to quench this thirst.
"It was a long time ago," he said.
She said she would write him a check right now. Would he let her? She would honestly like to. It had been on her conscience for so long. But he said no, no.
If it was a pub he first came to, well then so be it. He could get himself a Coke at least.
She had her head bowed. She no longer wore a clean part.
"I'm sorry, Billy," she said. "I've wanted to tell you so. It was cruel. It's just that I was afraid it would never happen. Tom getting this business going, us getting a place of our own. You know how it is when you're young, you're afraid your life will never get started. I got your money in my hands and I went a little mad."
"Dennis told me you died," Billy said easily. It was all part of a story now, and as story, it was nothing any of them had truly lived. He suspected there was a good joke in it, too, if he turned the tale around a bit, found the right way to look at it. He could see himself in Quinlan's, his glass to his heart, and Danny Lynch with his face gone red and his shoulders shaking the way they did when you really got him going. Eva nodded.
"We'd figured as much from your letters. Mary told me that's what he said he might do."
Billy nodded, too. "Did he?" He smiled a little. He couldn't risk another try at the cup, although his throat was parched. "Like something out of Romeo and Juliet, hey?"
He might even order a single shot, just one, to steady himself for the drive to Shannon.
Because the oath he'd taken was part of a story, too, when you came right down to it. Nothing, when you came right down to it, was unbreakable, unchangeable, under threat of eternal damnation. Who was kidding whom?
"Well, we're both still here," Eva said.
"There's the pity of it,"
he told her, feigning a brogue to make her smile. One shot for the road and maybe a beer at the airport before he met up with Father Jim. A single glass of stout. Even Father Jim might excuse him, pledge or no, if he knew what he'd been through this afternoon, if he could begin to appreciate this soaking sense of foolishness. She said she'd known him immediately, as soon as she came through the door, the stoop of his shoulders, those blue eyes. She knew him as if no time had passed at all since the days they had spent on Long Island. Sitting back from the table, his hands still in his lap, he said he'd be going out there again himself, to visit Dennis in Holtzman's little place, as soon as he returned to New York. He said he did so enjoy it out there, loveliest place on earth.
"How is Dennis?"
she asked, and he told her. He said,
"And Mary?"
Something came into her face then, something that had not been there before during those days they had spent on Long Island, anger and determination and disgust, an old bitterness, something the span of years had taught her.
"Mary," she said, pulling herself up as if to keep her nose above it.
"Mary, she doesn't hear from. Not since back then, if you want to know the truth. Not since Mary stopped hearing from Dennis, since he broke off with her. Mary wrote to her at one point back then to say that Dennis might even tell Billy she had died rather than let him know she had merely been cruel. 'You're as good as dead to me, too,' Mary wrote. 'You've ruined everything for me.'"
"If you can imagine,"
Eva said, with that new bitterness in her face, in her voice, coming in strong and familiar and true.
"A sister saying such a thing to her own flesh and blood. As if it was all my fault Dennis wanted no more to do with her. I wrote back to her and said Dennis was only doing what any decent man would do. It wasn't me who told her to be so loose and free with him."
Her skin was dry now, lined, hinting at the dust it would in another 2 or 3 decades become.
in truth, this time. It was awkward, Billy thought, more awkwardness to hear these angry words, these girlish concerns, on the lips of a plump old grandmother who long ago should have attained wisdom enough to dismiss this spleen. An old woman who should have wisdom enough to know that passion gone cold, gone way beyond its prime, was a pathetic thing. She stopped writing me after that. My younger sister sees her in New York on occasion. She went to college, City College. The Mr. and Mrs. helped her out, and she ended up taking a job as a teacher somewhere near a city named Binghamton. Never married. With some satisfaction.
And you're not in touch? Billy asked.
She shook her head. He might have said, until now, that time had not much changed her. I'm as good as dead to her, she said haughtily. And she to me, I might add. At Holtzman's place, in the two webbed lawn chairs they had set up on the sparse grass of the front lawn because the low steps where they had sat for so many nights when they were young were now too hard on their aging backs and sent pins and needles into their legs, Billy leaned forward, three sheets to the wind, and told Dennis that bitterness, then, was all that was left to it. Two old sisters locked in a silent transatlantic feud because of words exchanged about some boys they knew 30 years ago. Because one, you might say, had given too much, and the other had given too little. That was it, all that remained of their lovely idol in this lovely place. Faith inspired by anger, outstripping any inspired by affection. There it was. There was the way it had ended. Nothing but bitterness, truth be told, or pettiness at best. What was it the poet said? More substance in our enmities than in our love. My father shook his head. He leaned forward himself, his forearms on his knees. You've been done more harm than good by your poetry, he said. He knew he should send him packing. But Billy had refilled the flask in his pocket from the bottle he'd carried in his case, and he was too far gone to be put back on the train. Not that Dennis had the strength now to do it. In the morning, he'd send him off with a lecture he could already hear himself deliver, the one about killing yourself and maybe killing someone else as well. Think of Maeve, think of Rosemary and Kate, think of poor Father Jim and the trouble he took for you. Think of your friends, Billy. Think of me. He'd never said it before and would surely never say it again, but just this once he might tell him, think of me, Billy. Without Claire, without even faith or fancy enough left to send her my thoughts, never mind my prayers. Put aside your nonsense, Billy, put aside the past and think of those who really love you, who've loved you all along. Every one of us living proof, Billy, that it's a powerless thing, this loving one another, nothing like what you had imagined. Except in the way it persists. I'm sorry, Billy, was what he said instead, shaking his head. If it's an apology you're after, I'm sorry. I should have told you the truth long ago. But so much time passed, I suppose I began to think that it no longer mattered. Billy sat erect, bleary-eyed, incurable, and yet still there lingered. Was my father only imagining it? That old longing to admire in Billy's blue eyes, Billy's own persistent love.
It was quite a thing to pull off over all these years, he said softly.
Dennis agreed.
Quite a story to tell.
My father nodded, leaning forward, the sparse grass at his feet still sun-warmed although the day was changing, approaching evening. The whiff of tar from the heated black road fading enough now to let the sweetness of the scented air once again come through. Air that was the very memory of that time itself, all those years ago, that was now the very scent of longing.
Was it difficult?
Billy said with his thin smile.
Only at first, my father told him. After a while, I suppose I believed it myself.
Billy nodded.
Mary never married, he said again, handing him something. And she was a pretty girl, too, my father said, refusing it. Just goes to show you, you can never tell. I approached from the road and only caught their attention when I had crossed the gravel driveway. My father looked up. Billy turned a bit in his chair. I began talking right away so I would not have to look into Billy's wet eyes, into my father's dark and troubled ones. I met Matt West, I said, Mr. West's oldest son, the kid in the car this morning. Down at the beach, I said, not wanting to conjure the wide car, the lingering scent of marijuana. I was going to go out with him at 7 if the two of them didn't mind. Maybe a movie or something. I hoped they didn't mind. My father sat back. Billy's just here for the evening, he said severely. It's not a good night to make other plans. But Billy waved a hand, as my mother might have done. Go, he said, and to my father, let her go. Why in the world would she want to spend an evening with a couple of old geezers? He gestured toward the lawn and the road, the lengthening shadows and the still blue sky. On a night like this, he said, a summer night in this lovely place. He looked at me, barely able to go on. Go, he said, the tears welling, ready to spill. Have a lovely night, dear, with your boy. Go. That was the night we discovered where our childhoods merged. On a summer evening, one of the last, I suppose, we had spent with my grandmother at the Long Island place. My brothers and I were playing a netless game of badminton in one corner of the yard, while my mother and father and grandmother sat in a semicircle of webbed lawn chairs in another. Fragrant late summer evening, the sky streaked with brightness, pink and purple and gold, a touch of the bay in the cooling air that was itself touched with the very first hint of fall. There was a pitcher of martinis on an aluminum snack tray before them, a cracked plate of clams on the half-shell beside it, each one dotted with a bit of red cocktail sauce, decorated with a slice of lemon. All they knew of heaven. We could see the driveway from where we played, and so it must have been our slowing down and turning to look that first alerted my grandmother to her visitor, or maybe the sound of the wheels against the gravel. He got out of the car with the index card in his hand, and seemed about to show it to us, as if to ask for directions, before he noticed that there were adults on the premises as well. My father getting out of his chair to meet him, my grandmother, knowing more, right behind. She overtook my father just as Mr. West was removing his cap and immediately directed him back around to the front of the house. We heard their voices inside through the screen in the kitchen windows, and then again in the back bedroom. She seemed to be doing most of the talking. Her voice had grown huskier in her old age, still a redhead's voice, although spurning hair dye as she had spurned all self-deception, she had let her hair go white. My mother looked to my father, and my father shrugged. They exchanged a few words. He stood to top off their drinks. When my grandmother came back around the corner of the house, she had a number of $10 bills in her hand, and Mr. West had already once again started his engine. He drove back to your house in Amagansett, where the long, loud argument that for you was your parents' marriage began again. He came in while you and your brothers were at the dinner table with your mother. Something with ketchup, you said, as you remembered it. As you remembered it, every meal of your childhood smelled of ketchup, and then ducked your head to laugh, or because you had made me laugh. Your mother turned her back to him. This was the routine, and neither you nor your brothers were fooled by the icy silence. In a moment, you knew it would crack. Your father went banging into the walk-up attic, came banging down again with two suitcases, went banging into their bedroom. When he came through the kitchen again with the first suitcase, your mother asked, "What's this?" coolly, and he said, "I'm leaving." "Oh, sure," she mouthed to you and your brothers, who instantly wanted neither to take her side nor to believe him. She turned her back again when he returned, but when he came through the kitchen with the second suitcase, she sprang from her chair and followed him, through the kitchen door, down the steps, across the side lawn to the car.
There may be families, you said, who would lower their voices in the open air. Mine, for instance, I told you, who about this same time on that same night were listening quietly over our grilled round steaks to my grandmother's explanation regarding the sensibility of renting out the place all year, fond memories notwithstanding. But yours wasn't one of them. They were at each other a good 10 minutes out on the side lawn, and then your father swung back into the kitchen again, your mother right behind, trying to catch him by the back of his shirt. Both of them, with their eyes so bright and their jaws so set, with everything about them, you said, tunneled into their anger, unaware of, it seemed blind to, the three boys still at the table over the remnants of another ketchup dinner. Back into the bedroom. You was the operative word in these arguments, you said. You flung like a spitball. You peeled off and flung back again. Me? You. If they had only been able to decide which one of them was you, they might have known for certain and at last which one of them was to blame. They might have resolved something. Ducking your head again to smile. I liked your mouth, your dark eyes, the leather bracelet on your slim wrist. Your father spent the night, perhaps the next dozen of them, on his boat, because it was September at least school had started again, before he actually brought you and your brothers to the little house he had rented. You hated it, of course, the musty rooms and the blood-red shingles, and the sense that whatever latent capacity your father had to become a stranger was now realized as he moved around the tiny kitchen, opening cabinets and drawers and mumbling, "Now where does she keep frying eggs and bacon and serving them to you on faded china plates that were not his, not your mother's, that my mother had picked up, as a matter of fact, at the opportunity shop in East Hampton for a dollar or two, the remnant of another upheaval in yet another household, another summer, years ago. You hated the little house because it was proof positive, or so it had seemed to you then, that your parents' marriage was over, that the days of the five of you living together were over, that the anger and the shouting would never, as you had always believed, somehow resolve itself into love again. Peace. Don't even think about it, you told Cody and John. Don't even hope. You slept in the room with the particle board Buster Brown and Tige on the wall. My room, I said. That's where I always stay. We've already slept in the same bed then, you said, smiling, cutting all kinds of corners. Our amazement was at what we hadn't known until now, the parallels in our past no more delightful than what we were beginning to suspect our futures would contain, had contained for us all along, though we hadn't known. This was the lesson it taught you, you said. We were already on our way, clothes falling off as they did in those days, the sound of the ocean somewhere above us, the humid night, the same stars, our own summer idol. This was your particular take on your particular broken home. That in the absence of love, the evaporation, the disintegration, the tossing out of the equation of love, came peace. This was your particular take. You had one or the other, paid for one with the other. I agreed. It was, in those days, the way we all spoke about love, world-wise, open-eyed, without illusion, lying, of course, because what we truly believed at that moment, would believe on and off again for the rest of our lives, was that the whole history of Holtzman's little house, from its bankrupt builder to my grandmother's greed to your parents' bitter marriage, was, on this night, with our own meeting, redeemed. In the morning, at the breakfast table, Billy was bloodshot, but too skillful a drinker to seem hungover. He had showered and shaved with an electric razor, and his hair was wet, combed back. The open collar of his pale blue shirt showed the aging throat, the blotched skin of his neck. Nothing in his face or in his manner indicated that he had heard a word of the talking to my father had given him in his room, before Billy, or I for that matter, listening to my father's voice coming from behind the wall where Buster Brown and Tige were still hung, had even gotten out of bed. Killing himself and lying to everyone, and what about the trouble Father Jim went to, and what about AA again? It worked for Ted and for Mary Casey and for Uncle Jim. Why not? Why not? Billy's black satchel was already by the front door when he came into the kitchen. Seeing it there, he said,
"Here's your hat, what's your hurry?"
My father was at the stove frying eggs. He turned, smiling, and for a moment I thought he might relent, but he was as adept as his cousin was at keeping himself from what he most enjoyed.
"There's an 11:17 train," he said.
At the table, Billy took a spoonful of coffee and lost half of it as it made its shaky way to his mouth, dabbling his plate and his lap and the front of his shirt. He swiped at himself with his napkin and then removed a small pack of postcards and a fountain pen from his breast pocket. He put both on the table beside his plate.
"Another thing about Ireland," he said. "We are all over there, all our faces."
To me,
"I saw your dad driving a Guinness truck in Dublin, and his dad was moving a herd of sheep across the road up in the northwest."
He uncapped the pen and held it in one hand, but then put it down again when it was clear his trembling fingers could not manage it yet.
"I saw my mother," he went on. "Good Lord, I saw my mother in nearly every shop I went into, usually behind the counter. And my father's face was on one of the priests who said mass at the retreat house."
He lifted the cards, shuffled through them. The Duck Pond, Home Sweet Home, the Maidstone Club, a sunset on the beach at Amagansett.
"Everybody," he was saying, "you and Danny and Claire, both my sisters. Mac rented us a car at the airport. Ted Lynch was right behind us at a hurling match, and I'm sorry to say, Dennis, that he was pie-eyed for sure."
He winked at me.
"Easy does it, my foot," he said.
My father was smiling, an old habit. He couldn't help but get a kick out of Billy, even Billy hungover, lying to everyone. Billy incurable. Billy placed the cards on the table again, white side up. He took another spoonful of coffee, steadier now than with the last.
"I didn't see anyone who resembled Kate's Peter, though," he said, "which only proves what I've always said about that black Irish bit being a lie. Sulinowski turned to Sullivan, if you ask me."
He lifted the pen, turned the card over again to look at the photograph. Home Sweet Home.
"Maeve, of course," he said, "and her father. Her father's face was a dime a dozen over there. Uncle Jim, Bridie Shea as a girl again."
He began to write, slowly, carefully keeping control.
"Wouldn't that be a gift for poor Bridie to be a girl again? Sitting up there in her mother's window the way she used to, not a care in the world. I told Father Jim that it was like a taste of the hereafter going over there. I must have seen some version of every Irishman I know."
"What about yourself?"
my father said.
"Anyone look like you?"
Billy looked up from his postcard. He had written a single line across, two spindly words as far as I could see.
"Oh, sure," he said. "I was this young fellow in Clonmel, a regular legend around the gas station."
My father laughed a little, and Billy looked at me.
"Get your father to tell you the tale," he said. Although, of course, I never did, not then, my own future coming at me as it was. And I was too busy trying to make out what was written on the card under his hand.
"Beautiful friend," it looked like. Just the two words. And then I saw him address the card to Maeve. The Long Island house was squat, rectangular, red-shingled, and green-roofed, the shingles rough to the touch but sparkling in sunlight, flecked with mica. There were two windows in front, trimmed in deep green, a door between them, also green. Three wooden steps painted to match the door, the paint well peeled now, mostly showing bare board. The lawn in April was pale green, the blades of grass wet and thin, newborn. Even the low weeds that edged the property seemed freshly sprouted, as did the tangle of honeysuckle vine that covered the wire fence along the side, and that would in summer be tangled itself with the hum of bees. The gravel driveway was scattered with puddles. The road out front was still black from all the rain that had guaranteed Billy's swift ascent into heaven, but it was drying out now, a no longer solid brushstroke that by noon would have feathered back into dust along its edges. A road that on the hottest days gave off the same sharp odor it had had the moment it was spread. And swimming heat waves, of course, earth agitating air. The suburban homes and sandy cottages were mostly silent, lights on in only one or two of them, another Saturday morning gained. The crescent of Bay Beach was deserted, the rocks and shells collected at its edges, the dark wash of lapping water running over them and back again. The lot across the street was still empty, and still contained at its heart the remains of a crumbling foundation for a house that was never built, so well grown over by now that even in April the property was all fledgling weeds and dried stalks and last year's leaves. This had always been the view from the front steps of the Long Island house, the pale green lot, the tree line, the blue sky that in certain kinds of sunlight seemed to be reflecting the mirror flashes of sunlight off the bay. There was a screen door at the top of the steps, patched, as all screen doors in summer homes seem to be patched, against wire-cutting mosquitoes with a 2-inch square of mesh, upper right-hand corner of the top screen, always, a heavy green door behind it. The door opened onto a narrow room, a breath of mildew, of ocean dampness. A small rag rug at the door, another larger one under the heavy coffee table. 3 damp Reader's Digests on top, and a blue and white schedule for the Long Island Railroad, East Hampton Station. A wood-framed couch with tweed cushions worn white along the edges. A dark rocker, a plaid wingback. A table and lamp beside it, the base of the lamp a shellacked coil of rope. An old Cinzano ashtray, an ancient useless pack of matches from Jungle Pete's, a wrought iron floor lamp. There was a trace of last summer's sand on the wood floor under the couch, a trace of dust in every corner. Charcoal along the baseboards meant to discourage mildew. At the other end of the room, and open to it, the kitchen with its heavy formica table and red countertops and domed refrigerator. The sink was against the back wall, under a long row of narrow windows hung high enough to block the view for all dishwashers 5'2" and under. A backyard door beside the sink that contained the only curtained window in the house, all others being covered by yellowed shades. Another door beside the refrigerator that led to a narrow corridor that led to the 3 bedrooms. The only bath at the end of these, chipped white porcelain fixtures, the sink wobbly on steel mosquito legs, the cracked gray linoleum. Across the hall, the largest bedroom by an inch or two, and the brightest due to a second window, was painted yellow and decorated with 8 wooden shoe-store daisies tacked by my grandmother in an unfathomable constellation across the far wall. A tall dresser with a long bureau scarf, a night table with a milk-glass lamp, a magazine opened and folded back to show a white page filled with black print unrelieved by photographs, a pair of reading glasses placed over the page, placed there the night before because it was too late to finish, and there were too many words, and it was all about how much the citizenry loved the president, who was just an actor when you got right down to it, an actor reading them his lines. On the double bed, dark mahogany headboard, no footboard, white chenille spread folded back, thin floral sheets washed pale, my father opened his eyes to the same room he had gone to sleep in. The same room he had gone to sleep in. Then the shadowy circle of the milk-glass lamp, now sunshot early morning, ebb and flow of it as the breeze sucked in the bottom of the yellow shade and then let it go again, a child in a swing, to snap back against the sash. The very sound that had awakened him. Distant ringing of the buoys in the bay. Oh, but she's a girl. Scent of new grass and of ocean, of mildew, of the Long Island house, of Eastern Long Island. I am still here. He swung his feet out of the bed and sat for a moment. Nothing changed but the light, The magazine on the table, eyeglasses there, clothes in the chair, daisies, dresser, dop kit on the bureau, because his daughter was here with him and liked to keep her makeup bag on the back of the toilet. It was there when he made his way across the hall, pale pink and blue, plump. He nudged it gently when he lifted the lid. Back in the room, he raised the shade up above the open window so the snap of it wouldn't wake her, and then heard the same sound, faint but persistent, coming from the shade and window in her room next door. They had both kept the windows open all night then, despite the cold air. There was still mist on the gray grass, mist all along the vine-covered fence. There was no place in the world he'd rather wake to. He stood for a moment between the dresser and the bed and offered himself as some elemental part of understanding. The same room he had gone to sleep in, consciousness dropped and then picked up again. Only the light changed. The return of day. In the kitchen, he put the kettle on, cut oranges and squeezed them under his palm on an old-fashioned glass juicer, the very one, in fact, his mother had used when he was young in the apartment in Woodside. The very one, washed up on this shore somehow after what he imagined had been a long newspaper-wrapped odyssey, box-bound, from that tiny kitchen in Queens to the basement of Holtzman's house in Jamaica. Years passing there, light in the narrow basement window and then darkness, light again, 1,000 times over, while he himself returned from overseas, met Mary, met Claire, married, had children, until someone, himself, Holtzman, his mother, hoisted the box marked kitchen things and brought it out here to the Long Island house, where it dropped out of his sight for years and then returned again as something he shared with Mr. West while he was still my mother's tenant and not yet my daughter's father-in-law, and then found himself on this morning in April, the second morning with Billy in his grave, surprised and even delighted by the thing, by the things that ride out time. He poured the juice into two short, thick glasses, washed and dried his hands. He pulled open the back door, frames sticking, curtains swinging. On a stage, the whole wall would have moved with it. He stepped out onto the narrow back porch, where the brushstrokes in the dark green paint were his own and Billy's. Marvelous, sweet spring air of eastern Long Island. New grass and sweet blossom and tang of sea salt. In the bright green of the pale trees, high up, narrow shafts of yellow sunlight, theatrical as well. The soundtrack bird song, gulls and sparrows and distant crows. He did a few calisthenics, his arms winter pale, the fine hairs on them mostly gray, certainly grayer than Claire had ever seen them. By sundown, his arms will have turned a ruddy brown, what with the work he had planned, clippers and scythe and scraping some paint. He touched his waist, his shoulder, raised his hands above his head, looking for all the world like a man giving praise. The return of day. Inside, the plumbing was moaning and clunking, the sound of water rushing through the walls as if the place had been framed in pipes, not lumber. His daughter in the shower. He took the breakfast tray from under the counter, placed cups and saucers on it, bowls, cereal, sugar, spoons, a carton of milk, a jar of jam. He toasted 4 slices of bread and poured water into the teapot just as she came into the kitchen. Barefoot, sweatpants and an old t-shirt, her hair wet and smelling of shampoo. "Good morning, Glory," he said, and she said, "Good morning," the towel draped around her shoulders. She had already been out for a run, she said, down to the beach and back, and he realized that the shade he'd heard had been snapping in an empty room. Tomorrow, they'd drive back to Rosedale. Tomorrow evening, she'd fly home. He lifted the tray, and she walked ahead of him through the living room. She once more unlocked the green door, pulled it open, sunlight and birdsong transforming a long shaft of the damp, dark room. She stepped outside, holding the screen open for him. He said, "Thank you, ma'am," and then caught the door with his elbow to let her go first. She went to the bottom step and then turned to take the tray from him, but he said, "I've got it," and let the screen door close behind him as he stepped down and turned to place the tray carefully, crockery rattling, on the top step. He sat beside it. She sat below him, at his feet, shaking out her hair, running her fingers through it, and wafting a shampoo that was some false yet strenuous version of the scent of the spring air. He lifted the teacup and poured for her. She reached back. "Thank you," she said.
"You're most welcome."
She sipped from the cup. The breeze that had woken him had grown weaker in the sun, but something of the cold dawn still lingered. One did not dare say to a grown daughter, a married woman with children of her own, "Are you warm enough? Do you need a sweater? Wouldn't you rather wear shoes?" He said,
"You'll have to give the in-laws a call while you're here."
I said yes. I had already told them I'd stop by.
"There's a happy pair,"
my father said, meaning Mr. West and his wife, united again now that their three boys had grown and flown. Nesting again, as you yourself had said, in the Amagansett house. Nesting among the ruins. What was more tenacious, you'd said, than the desire to be connected, especially in old age? More tenacious than fact, than memory. Your parents would turn away wide-eyed whenever you or your brothers said, "But you hated..." They'd only needed space, they would tell you, turning our own words against us. They'd only gone through a rough patch in their marriage that had, unlucky for you boys, more or less corresponded to your childhoods. Sitting on the steps of the Long Island house, Billy 2 days in his grave, my father and I discussed what the little house needed to have done to get it in shape for summer, for his retirement next year, when he would put the Rosedale house on the market and live out here permanently. Another overhaul, long overdue. Insulation, plumbing, heating, paint. Redoing and then supplementing all that work he and Billy had done years ago. New furniture. A real garden once he was out here permanently. Plenty of visitors, too, what with a good 6 months to schedule them, April through September at least, maybe October, too. My three brothers and their families would each take a turn, and he hoped I'd come in from the coast with the children. Take at least a week or two. My father sat on the step above me, the step he would begin to scrape and sand that very afternoon, and looking toward the blue sky above the bay and the crescent beach behind the tree line, he described for me all the ways he would spend his time in this lovely place, still old Holtzman's place when you came right down to it, his surprise inheritance from a mother who hadn't put much stock in elaborate emotion, but nevertheless had married twice and loved him, and had said at the end, having scattered Holtzman's money to the charitable winds, "Bring Billy out there with his wife." Because when you got right down to it, there were all kinds of things in her heart and in her mind that we never knew. There was, for instance, her capacity to believe. There was as well her capacity to be deceived, since you can't have one without the other, each one side of the other. He'd have the Quinns out, my father said. Mickey will be retiring soon, too, and all the various Lynches, sure, Danny, too, and Bridie when she needed a break in a beautiful place from taking care of poor Jim. He'd have the Caseys out, and both sets of our Rosedale neighbors, my mother's sister Louise with her family, although she drove him crazy. And, he said, he'd ask Maeve. I looked at him over my shoulder. I'd been thinking, as he counted off the names, how clear it was that Billy's was missing from the list, although Billy over the years would not come. And I thought then that my father mentioned her name just for that, for Billy's sake. He said, "Maeve's never been out this way as far as I know. She should see it. She would enjoy it." I nodded. "Sure," I said. I could imagine her, I supposed, getting off the train at the East Hampton station, tentative and slow, her hand on the rail beside the steps, the plain pearl ring, for much longer than was necessary, lingering there until the conductor offered her his own hand to help her down. Dorothy, or maybe Bridie, behind her, since it would not do for her to come out here all alone. A simple dress or a pantsuit for traveling, her round face and her short hair. My father would take her bag, take her for lunch across the street, take her on the usual tour past the beautiful houses, cottages, he'd say, that neither one of them would have ever thought to own or even to enter, but would be content, as we'd all been content, to merely pass by and admire. Billy's idea of heaven, he'd tell her. The idea itself, sufficient alone. Early evening in the lawn chairs on the sparse lawn, a cocktail, then dinner in town or maybe something on the grill. The far bedroom for privacy's sake, with the bed turned down. Fresh worn towels from the Rosedale house on the dresser for her. A laugh over the smiling pressed wood seahorse on the wall, another decoration from Holtzman's store. Holtzman with his literal wealth, the one in the long run who had changed the lives of them all. Even my daughter, he would say. She met Matt out here, you know. Figurative wealth changing nothing in the long run, except maybe the stories that were told.
If it comes to a choice between love and money, my father would tell Maeve, repeating an old joke, take money.
And then bringing her back to the station on Sunday afternoon, after Mass and a bit of breakfast. The gorgeous people on the platform with her, most of them young, all of them transformed by a weekend in the sun, fruit and wildflowers in their arms. Maeve would be working by then, 2 years, 3 years after Billy's death. A little job Ted Lynch found for her with the Archdiocese once she'd convinced him that whatever inclination she'd had to enter a convent had disappeared long ago. The sweet Indian couple meeting her at the Bayside station and driving her home to the narrow house where she now lived alone with the dog. Peacefully, she would have to say. Where she would begin to wonder, no doubt, when Dennis would invite her out again, because it was so lovely out there, and because Billy had so loved the place, regardless of how vigorously and for how long he had deprived himself of it. He had, after all, deprived himself of much that he loved best. Poor man. Hoping he would invite her out again, because when she and Dennis sat at the table last night with a piece of toast and a cup of tea, the dead were there with them, just outside the circle of light. Billy and Claire, not forgotten, no less mourned, but silent for now. In dreams, their faces always turned away, so that the course of other lives, the lives of those they'd loved, could be completed, could go on. Surely just as the Irish girl, whom Billy had loved when he was young, just back from the war, had eventually turned her face away. No less remembered, no less mourned. My father would say it himself in another 6 or 7 years' time, as we sat together on these steps again and I watched our children playing croquet on the lawn, wondering, counting how many more years would such summers continue, my father alive, our children still children, how many more were enough? No less loved now as then, my father would say, breaking the news. But still, life goes on. Some relief is required, some compensation. I would look at him over my shoulder. Was it penance, I'd want to ask him? Was it compensation for an old and well-intentioned lie, for the life it had deprived her of? Or was it merely taking care? More taking care, a hand held out once again to whoever happened to be nearby. I couldn't ask, of course, and it was impossible to say. His capacity for sympathy was no less than Billy's for self-denial. Their faith, both of them, all of them, I suppose, was no less keen than their suspicion that in the end they might be proven wrong, and their certainty that they would continue to believe anyway. They were married in March of 1991, my father and Maeve. At the little church in East Hampton, Most Holy Trinity now, no longer St. Philomena's, the poor woman having been tossed out of the canon.